Listener note before we begin. In this conversation, we sometimes use the term women, but more broadly, we mean people who can get pregnant, including trans and non-binary folks. From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Last week, the draft opinion for the decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization was leaked. Justice Alito wrote the draft opinion, both overturning Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Everything about what has happened is remarkable: the leak, the decision, and the reasoning. The repercussions for what it means for people who can get pregnant are dire. And if that wasn't enough, the repercussions may as well extend far beyond. Last week, we focused our conversation on what the draft opinion would mean for reproductive access. Today, we're going to focus on the second tier of impact, what this precedent could mean for other civil rights and civil liberties, and what this means for the institution of the court itself. For this episode, we're bringing in our resident constitutional expert, David Cole. David is the National Legal Director of the ACLU and has argued a variety of cases before the Supreme Court himself. He joins us today to help us digest the news as it settles. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kendall.
So, David, it's been a matter of days since the draft opinion was leaked. So to start with something simple, I was wondering if, you know, you're the National Legal Director at the ACLU. How is this all settling with you?
Well, it's profoundly, profoundly disturbing. I don't think any of us thought before this term began that the court would go as far as it now appears ready to go. At the oral argument in Dobbs, it did seem like five justices might well be willing to overturn Roe versus Wade, but that itself was shocking. These are new justices. Three of the justices are new justices. Amy Coney Barrett's been on the court just over a year. Brett Kavanaugh just over 3 years. Gorsuch just about 5 years. And ordinarily, new justices tread lightly, and you would expect, especially when you've been appointed by a president who proclaimed loudly that he was appointing you to the bench in order to overturn Roe versus Wade, that you would be disinclined to do that on your first shot because you don't want to suggest that the court is a political weapon of the president who uses a litmus test. And yet that appears to be what they're ready to do.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, it has been a really concerning week. There's been a lot of debriefing on the draft opinion, what it means for Roe, what it means for people who can get pregnant. I want to be clear that this is the core problem. This is problem number one, and all the others follow in importance. So, David, can we get a level set on what you see for reproductive access in America right now? What does the overturn of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, what would that mean for the future of reproductive access?
Well, it's disastrous. Certainly in the short term, it's disastrous. It means that I think about half the states will impose either total bans or very, very restrictive rules on abortion. And so for people who live in those states, the only way that they would be able to get an abortion is by traveling outside of the state. Many of those states adjoin each other, and so you'd have to travel very far. You'd have to have the means to do so. You'd have to have the time to do so. You're basically taking away from all women, and particularly from poor women, young women, women of color, who are disproportionately those who need abortion care. You are taking away from them probably the most important right they have, the right to control their bodies, their fates, their families. It's really just a very deeply disturbing if, in fact, this draft becomes the final opinion.
Another thing I want to touch again very briefly on is the leak itself. There's been a lot of discussion about the leak, particularly from what it seems to me is like male senators, journalists. It can feel like a method of distraction, but is it? Can you tell us a little bit about what the leak means and what it doesn't mean?
Well, I think it's hard to know, in precisely what it means without knowing who did it. There's all kinds of speculation. It is certainly unprecedented that a draft opinion of the Supreme Court would be leaked. It's one of the few governmental institutions that has been largely immune from leaks. So that is very disturbing. You know, I think it's quite possible that it was leaked in a strategic way by a conservative to try to make sure that the five who originally voted to overturn Roe would not shift their positions, because it's obviously harder to shift your position once your position has been public. The last time around, 30 years ago, when the Supreme Court was deciding whether to overturn Roe, there were initially five votes to overturn Roe after the argument. But over the course of the drafting, all of which took place internally, Justice Anthony Kennedy switched his vote and decided, no, he thought the better course was to uphold Roe. But it's much harder to do that if your vote and your views have already been publicly displayed. So I think it makes it less likely that there will be a shift in the court. It's still possible that there will be a shift away from this majority opinion, but I think the leak makes it less likely.
Well, it's definitely created a lot of chaos, I imagine, for the court. I want to turn our conversation toward discussing what this overturn would mean for the Supreme Court. It flies in the face of one of the court's most treasured principles, stare decisis. So first, for some groundwork, what is stare decisis and why is it important?
So stare decisis is the basic, it's sort of the fundamental building block of the rule of law. It's the notion that as a court and as a justice, you agree to be bound in the future by decisions that are entered today and decisions that have been entered in the past. And it's designed to ensure that people have stability in their lives, that the rule of law, is predictable, that it doesn't change all that much, and that judges have to make decisions based on principle and not based on their gut judgments or their particular reactions to a particular set of circumstances. It's not an ironclad rule. The court has overturned precedents in the past. It's not precluded from doing so, but it has to be a very high bar before the court overturns precedents. It's done so, does so rarely. It does so especially rarely in a situation like this to eliminate a right. Justice Alito cites Brown versus Board of Education. I mean, kind of remarkably, he cites Brown versus Board of Education, which overturned Plessy versus Ferguson's separate but equal doctrine. And he cites that to justify his action, as if to say, hey, it's not a big deal. And in fact, some of our greatest opinions overturned prior precedents. And it's true that some of the greatest court's opinions have overturned prior precedents. Brown versus Board, certainly one of them. And Alito cites all of those. Mm-hmm. But what he doesn't, acknowledge is that all of those decisions expanded constitutional rights protections. And when you look back at the history of our constitutional doctrine, what you see is that it's essentially an evolving and expanding set of rights. The rights that we enjoy today would basically be unrecognizable to the framers of the Constitution. And that's because courts have overturned prior rules and expanded rights fairly consistently. It's not always expansive, but generally, the general trend is definitely expansive. Very, very rare that the court overturns precedent to take away or cut back on a right, sometimes to cut back at the margins, but to eliminate a right, almost never. So this is a huge, huge radical step to eliminate a right that has been recognized for 50 years and that extends formally to half the country, to all the women in the country, and that it really protects all people in the country, because of course, many, many men who are involved with women in relationships, depend just as much on the ability to decide when and whether to have a family, as the women do. So it is a truly radical decision from a stare decisis point of view.
I appreciate the point you just made there that men also benefit from Roe, because I think that has been largely missing from the conversation in the aftermath of the draft opinion. You did tee up perfectly the next thing I want to dig into, which is, Justice Alito's reasoning behind undoing Roe. He writes that Roe was egregiously wrong from the start because it doesn't have to do with the original intent of the Constitution. Some are calling this logic a direct attack on the Ninth Amendment, which talks about unenumerated rights. So first off, can you give us a little background? What does the Ninth Amendment say or guarantee? And do you agree with that concern based on what you read?
So yeah, the Ninth Amendment was added to the Bill of Rights. It basically says the fact that the rights not enumerated herein are nonetheless reserved to the people, or something, that's a paraphrase, but that's basically sure. It. And the idea was to underscore that the list of rights that comes in the first eight amendments, those are definitely very important rights, but they're not all the rights that people have or should have. And I think it underscores this idea that, look, they wrote the Constitution for the ages, not for, a decade, not for 20 years, not for even for 50 years, but for the ages. And so if you're doing that, you have to write in fairly broad terms and allow for evolution. One of the broad mm-hmm. terms they used was liberty. And liberty is the provision that the court has consistently used to define a set of decisions that people have the right to make without the government intruding upon them. And so those things include things like who you live with, who you marry, whether you have sexual relations with another consenting adult, where you send your kids to school, how you educate your kids. None of them are explicitly set forth in the Constitution, but the court has recognized each one of them as part of this notion of liberty, the autonomy of the individual to make certain core important decisions that should be made by individuals because they affect those individuals so deeply, and not by the state. Whether and when to have a child is the same sort of decision and therefore is protected by liberty. That's what the court has said for 50 years. What Justice Alito says is, no, we're only going to protect rights when they are not explicitly specified in the Constitution, if they are deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition. And so then he then goes back and looks at our history and tradition at the time of the framing of the Constitution, at the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment, and finds that, no, abortion wasn't a right at that time. And that's true, but neither was the right to marry someone of a different race. Neither was the right to marry someone, of your own gender. Neither was the right to use contraception. These are all rights that have been developed over time as the Constitution evolves and as people's sense of what is important to their autonomy develops. So he would essentially send us back in time to the time of the framing, the time that the amendments were initially adopted, and say, absent an express, strict, specific guarantee in the Constitution, we are not going to protect it unless it's deeply rooted in history and tradition. And that, would basically turn back the clock dramatically.
Dramatically, yes. In seeking to justify this dismissal of the Ninth Amendment, he explains that, to your point, liberty isn't our ardent views, in quotes, of what freedoms we should have. And so I think people are really concerned about what this means for gay marriage, interracial marriage, and contraceptives. The Obergefell case, which was an ACLU case, it was a 5-4 decision. This is the case that extended gay marriage nationally. And all of the dissenters in that 5-4 decision are still on the bench. Justice Alito in 2020 notably references the Obergefell decision as, in quotes, ruinous consequences for religious liberty. So he's very clear that he's not a fan. I mean, I think I've seen a lot of discussion about these cases, Griswold v. Connecticut, Loving v. Virginia. What are the implications for these cases should this draft stand as it is?
Well, I think that's the $64,000 question. On the one hand, he seeks to distinguish all of those cases by saying this right, the right to abortion, is different from all other rights because it involves the destruction of a potential life. And therefore, the message seems to be, well, you know, we're this far and no further. On the other hand, the doctrine that he announces, the analysis that he uses, the method is much broader than that. It says, if it's not expressly set forth in the Constitution, we're not going to protect it unless you can show that it was protected, you know, in our history and traditions at the time that these amendments were adopted. And that would put contraception and interracial marriage and same-sex marriage at risk. That would put women's equality at marriage, for God's sakes, because the Equal Protection Clause was adopted in 1868 after the Civil War as part of the 14th Amendment. And at the time, it was not understood to make laws that distinguished on the basis of sex unconstitutional. They were common. They were upheld for years and years and years. And it was not until the 1970s that the Supreme Court actually ruled that, in fact, the Equal Protection Clause protects women. So, you know, all bets are off if he really means to say that that standard should apply across the board.
Yes. And to that end, actually, I wanted to ask you about this acknowledgement of women, notably missing from the draft opinion, are women. Women are not really mentioned as how this will impact their lives. There is a significant difference in omitting women from Roe v. Wade when it was argued, and this is, you know, an argument that Linda Greenhouse put forth in the New York Times, and omitting women now when there is jurisprudence for sex equality on the books. We have been here. We've done this work. What do you make of this kind of stark omission? Because it strikes me as unbelievably important in considering that we are talking about the idea of saving lives, and we know that the United States struggles with poor maternal mortality rates, struggles with other policy that would support families. And a lot of these bans that people are putting forth, there are no exceptions for rape and incest. There are very few exceptions for the life of the mother. We've seen states pop up with ectopic pregnancies mentioned in their bans. How does this all square with you?
So it's very, very disturbing. I mean, in two respects. One is he essentially erases women from the calculus here. The first is he sort of has about a paragraph and a half addressing whether there's an equal protection problem with the restrictions on abortion. I mean, after all, there are no similar restrictions on any medical, treatment that a man gets, and yet every woman faces this this effort to control her decision about whether or not to have a child, and there have been very strong arguments that that raises serious equal protection problems, and in fact, in the Casey decision, which upheld Roe 30 years ago, the court talked about the role that this decision has played in the equal status of women in our society today. And he essentially rejects that and says, this isn't discrimination against women. It's discrimination against pregnant people. And since some women are pregnant and other women are not, this isn't discrimination on the basis of sex. Citing a decision that Justice Rehnquist wrote 100 years ago, that used that same rationale to say that when an employer fires someone for being pregnant, it's not sex discrimination because not all women are pregnant. And that was ridiculous when it was first stated. It was rejected by Congress almost immediately, which amended Title VII to say, no, in fact, when you discriminate against someone because they are pregnant, you are engaged in sex discrimination. And so that's his analysis on equal protection, completely flimsy. And then he turns to a question of reliance interests, which is something the courts look at under stare decisis. When you decide, when you're deciding whether to overturn a decision, you ask, well, have people come to rely on this decision? Because if they have, we ought to be very careful about overturning it. And there he basically just throws up his hands and says, well, we can't actually know, you know, whether people have relied on Roe or not. I mean, who is he kidding? This is a decision that has been around 50 years that has allowed women to, and men, as I was saying before, to think about how to plan their lives, to enter careers, to go to school, to make all sorts of critical life decisions, knowing that they have the option to have an abortion if they, you know, if there's a an unwanted pregnancy and they're not ready, they can't afford, they're not psychologically ready, financially ready, whatever. Many, you know, families can't afford to have another child. So so to say cavalierly that we can't know whether this decision, which protects probably the most important decision, you know, a woman makes, we can't know whether this is, you know, women have relied on that. I mean, it's just as if, you know, he has never talked to a woman. I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable decision.
I was going to say that myself. So I want to turn to addressing the political nature of what this decision could mean. In a recent Slate op-ed, Leah Littman and Stephen Vladeck write about why they are concerned by the court showing its political cards in this way. They write that some conservative legal commentators, Wall Street Journal, etc., say that there is no reason for concern. According to the Journal, unlike Roe, the decisions protecting contraception and marriage equality, in quotes, have broad public acceptance, as evidenced by Gallup polls. David, can you remind us, what is the public opinion on Roe?
Well, it's a majority, and in many polls, an overwhelming majority, want Roe to be preserved, not overruled. And you know, some polls mark at above 70% of Americans who want Roe to be preserved. Others over 55%. But it's clear that the majority view here is to uphold Roe, not to reverse Roe. Of course, the court's job is not to, like, you know, take a vote on issues and rule that way. That's what the legislature is there for. That's not what the court is there for. But it is the case that if the court, I mean, it's supposed to be deciding issues of principle, and it's supposed to be deciding them even if they're unpopular. But if the court gets too far out of step with where the country is on fundamental values, like whether a woman should have the right to make this decision, you know, then I think it really does test the legitimacy of the court. Historically, in our country, the courts have rarely departed very dramatically from where the people are on fundamental issues, you know, as polls measure them and the like. Mm-hmm. In a few instances, it has, and each time it has led to a backlash. It's undermined their legitimacy. It's tested the court. And so, you know, I think, you know, if there what we're likely to see here if the court overturns Roe is a very, very powerful response from the American people. And that response, I think, you know, will have, I think, two beneficial effects. One, over time, and it will take some time, and there will be a lot of pain in the interim, but over time, I think we will come to some consensus about protecting an abortion right. Look, if Ireland, a Catholic, deeply Catholic country, can do so, surely we can. But that will take a long time, and it will only happen if you know, people who care about the right engage and respond and vote like their rights depend on it. The second thing that will happen, if people engage, if there's the backlash that I think there likely will be, again, you know, as I was saying earlier, in part because the court has never before taken away a right from literally half the population in a single stroke. That response should have some disciplining effect on the court. The court is not, you know, it has to operate in society. It has to pay attention. You know, this decision suggests that it's not. But if there's a strong reaction from those of us who care about rights to this kind of decision, that will make it less likely that we'll see other decisions like this down the line.
So what you're saying here is that we do have some power in this. I think a lot of people feel really powerless after reading that draft opinion, after hearing the news. It's good to hear from you that we still have some role in this. Before we get to other things that we can do, I want to address a couple of more notes on just the analysis of the draft opinion and what that could or would mean about the court. So it's clear from the draft opinion that Alito would like issues, again, not explicitly stated in the Constitution, to be policy issues. David French, a columnist at The Atlantic, wrote about how he thinks Alito got this right. The Supreme Court shouldn't be legislating rights. Justice Ginsburg in 1992 argued, quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes, that judges do and must legislate. So, David, can you help us here? What is the role of the Supreme Court, and do they legislate?
Well, that's kind of it's semantics. They don't legislate in the sense of they don't pass laws like the legislature does. The legislature can, you know, pass whatever law it wants on a wide variety of issues. It has, you know, it can take an initiative, doesn't have to wait for a case to come before it. It can change its mind, you know, the day after it enacts a law, it could repeal it. So the legislature has a much broader authority than the courts do. And when courts sort of get out of line, people say they're legislating. They use that as a kind of metaphor to say they're doing too much. And that's what Alito is saying about Roe. And many conservatives have said that about Roe. I disagree with that. I think that, as I said before, the framers of the Constitution drafted the Bill of Rights with broad terms like liberty, due process, equal protection, understanding that they could not foresee every development over the next several centuries, and they wanted this Constitution to last. And I think that's the better view of the Constitution, the only view of the Constitution that's sort of consistent with democracy or common sense. You know, but that is clearly not the view of the conservative justices on the court, including Justice Roberts. I mean, there are six justices who would probably reject that view and take a much more kind of originalist view that's just not adequate when you're talking about core fundamental norms, again, like the right to abortion. You can't leave that to the political process precisely because it is a personal decision, just like you can't leave to the political process. So I just fundamentally disagree with that view of how the Constitution should be interpreted, but that is, that is certainly the view that six of the court's justices today hold.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you make because, you know, we elect our representatives. We know how often elections are. It seems that then certain things that we've grown to understand that are rights would then change with the whims of whoever happened to be elected at that time. And we can also, that can lead us into a whole other conversation about, you know, who is actually represented in our electoral system and whose, you know, opinions and views matter and all of that. But I do want to go to something else that I think is really important, which is just as we are reading this draft opinion and trying to understand the reasoning that the court is using and how that will impact future rights, future legislation across the country, so is the opposition. And I guess I was wondering if you could, you know, talk a little bit about how this draft opens the door and, you know, perhaps even shows favorability for state legislatures who are hoping to usher other laws through that negatively impact bodily autonomy. I think, like, if this moves to the states, right, which it seems that's going to be true, I think there's a lot of concern because we're already seeing some kind of bold indicators from states like Louisiana and Tennessee. Louisiana just popped up a bill out of, you know, committee that is set to criminalize abortion, miscarriage, and IVF. Tennessee is also moving to make mail order abortion medications a felony. Meanwhile, Alabama just banned gender affirming care for transgender kids. This is like all part and parcel of the same thing. So what do you expect to see when this all moves to the states, if it does?
Well, I do expect, I mean, as your question points out, we've already seen some, very far-reaching acts by legislatures to restrict the rights of individuals to make personal decisions about their own bodies. And we are going to, if this decision says that's fine in the realm of abortion, you're definitely going to see legislatures push further and say, well, if it's fine in the area of abortion, then it ought to be fine in the area of contraception. If it's fine in the area of contraception, then it ought to be fine in the area of gender affirming care and the like. So, you know, to some degree, there's very little limitation because essentially what the court is saying is we're going to be out of this business of regulating what people can do, you know, of regulating what states and legislatures can do in seeking to control people's decisions about their own bodies. That said, I think, as I said before, you know, much depends on how we respond. If mm-hmm. the nation responds, as I think we've already seen indications that it will, if the nation responds with a very, very powerful political rejection of this kind of reasoning, of this kind of decision of eliminating a right, and reaffirms in a political way the critical importance of bodily autonomy to human flourishing and liberty and constitutional rights, I think that will put a check on how far the court can go. So again, you know, it's in our hands, not in their hands.
And I know that we don't like to opine on what will happen in the future, but I have you here. I can only imagine that people want to know what you think about what we will see when we see the decision in its full form. Do you have any thoughts? Do you think it's going to stay?
I think I can't. I have no ability to predict in any kind of detail. If I were a betting person, I would bet that these five justices stay where they are. You know, I hold out this hope that one of them might, you know, peel off and join Chief Justice Roberts, who is reportedly taking a more modest view, still a view that would uphold this law, the law which prohibits abortions after 15 weeks, but would not overturn Roe and Casey, would simply, you know, limit the right to the first, say, 15 weeks of pregnancy. You know, I have some glimmer of hope that one justice will go that way, and then that will be the decision that really decides the case, because I fully expect the three liberal justices to uphold Roe and Casey. But, you know, it's a very, very slim, you know, glimmer of hope that I hold there.
The ACLU represents many issues. This is a draft opinion that calls into question so much of what we work on. So, from a legal perspective, I was wondering if you could shed a little bit of light on kind of how we're viewing this and where we're going to be focused, and also then where our supporters can help.
We're going to be focused full force on restoring the right to abortion. And much of that work is going to be political. Much of it is going to be lobbying in the states, fighting legislative battles in the states. I think the politics will be significantly affected by this decision. I think there are many, many Republicans who've kind of been able to sort of gesture at being opposed to abortion while knowing, because of the Supreme Court decision, that their daughters could still get an abortion if they needed one. That freedom is no longer going to be there. And so I think it'll be a moment of truth for a lot of Republicans. I think it'll be a moment of, you know, get up out of your seat for many Democrats. And that will be the central battle ground, will be the state legislatures, what kinds of laws they pass when this issue gets sent back to them. We will also be in court. We will be pursuing state constitutional protections for the right to abortion in states where we have a shot at making that sort of argument. We'll be making other kinds of arguments to, for example, protect, ensure that if you live in a state that doesn't have the right to abortion, you can go safely go outside of that state, get an abortion there, and that state can't try to restrict your freedom to do so, which some states have started talking about, but clearly is unconstitutional under our Constitution. So, you know, we're going to be doubling down on this issue. But I think also we need to think about how the response to this issue may, affect all sorts of other fights. Because, you know, this is going to be a tidal wave. And, I think we need to be part of the tidal wave of response. But I also think we need to think about how we can use that tidal wave of response to shore up other rights protections from, what many people will justifiably fear is going to be an onslaught from the Supreme Court.
And of course, you know, I think we naturally look to the midterm elections where, you know, we have a very robust voting rights operation. As you mentioned, a lot of this is going to be political. We have a whole team of folks that are ready to kind of plug people in to help in battleground races states. For people who are willing or interested in participating in that, they can go to aclu.org/abortion-pledge. That's aclu.org/abortion-pledge. And that will also be in the description of this episode. So people can plug in and get involved, whether that's door knocking or phone calling or all different kinds of petition signing. We have plenty of things that people can get plugged in on there as well.
I mean, our people power.
People power
gives people the opportunities to engage in particular actions designed to protect rights, and I'm sure will be largely focused on abortion rights. But you know, the bottom line is vote like your rights depend on it, and make sure that your friends and family vote like their rights depend on it, and that every little bit helps, that every person who stands up and participates in the fight makes the fight that much stronger. Everyone, I think, it's totally natural for everyone to think, oh, what can I do? I'm just one person. Look, we are all just one person. The only way we can be effective is if, despite the fact that we're only one person, we get up with others in association, organize, demonstrate, lobby, vote, register people to vote, and the like. That is how democracy works. We're good at it. So we're happy to work with all like-minded people in fighting for the preservation of this fundamental right and of so many others.
Thank you so much for joining us, David. Really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thanks, Kendall.
Thanks so much for listening. We have a long fight ahead of us, but the ACLU was made for moments like this. To donate to support our fight against the attack on reproductive autonomy and all the attacks that follow, please visit aclu.org/keepfighting. That's aclu.org/keepfighting. To get involved in our people power effort to protect abortion access, please visit aclu.org/abortion-pledge. That's aclu.org/abortion-pledge. These links will be in the description box as well. Thank you so much for stepping up and working together with us. Until next week, stay strong.